Sanborn with the Curtis Mayfield anthem, People Get Ready. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Wednesday, February the 6th, and we come to the conclusion of our topic that we started on Monday, revisiting what I consider to be a historic conversation, a wide-ranging conversation, among four luminaries at the time in the civil rights movement, giving their unique perspectives on what was unfolding at the time, the mass involvement of people in advancing this country's civil and human rights. And of course, it was fraught with contradiction, it was fraught with victory, it was fraught with trial and tribulations, it was fraught with all kinds of theories as to what should the next move be. But still, one thing that cannot be doubted is their commitment to this movement and the commitment to making a contribution, even as they struggled with internal contradictions. The four people involved in this discussion were Wyatt T. Walker, who was the chief of staff of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and at the time executive assistant to Dr. Martin Luther King. There was Alan Morrison. He was the New York editor of Ebony magazine, and Ebony, you should know, was and still is one of the largest distributed publications among the African American community in the United States here. There was James Farmer, the national director of the Congress of Racial Equality, and Malcolm X, then known as Minister Malcolm X. He was Minister of the Nation of Islam's Mosque Number 7, as you know. He later left the Nation of Islam. The frank discussion had to do with what was the right thing to do. They all agreed that the civil and human rights of African Americans had been just decimated over centuries. And the question was, how was this to be resolved? Was this a political solution? Was it a social solution? Was it an economic solution? It was all of the above and then some. They were assembled for this discussion by Richard Heffner, who was the PBS host of a program called The Open Mind. It was a fantastic program, by the way, and he served as moderator for this discussion. Where we are going now is 30 years later. This discussion, the initial one, was held in 1963. We go now to 30 years later, in 1993. And we have to bear in mind, for us listening to this conversation, we're listening to a conversation that started 50 years ago. And as I noted in the first instance, everything seemed to have remained the same. The struggles against an obstreperous system that simply would not yield to just demands. We had it then, we have it now. But 30 years later, Richard Heffner engaged in a review with only the two people of the original four at that time, in 1993, were alive. Of course, you know that Malcolm X had been assassinated in 1965, and Morrison, the editor, died in 1968. So this is a discussion with the two remaining members of the original set, Wyatt T. Walker and James Farmer. So we go now to their observations, and you will see how, with the distance of time between them, the 30 years of distance from the first discussion, here's what they talked about and here were their observations. When we come back from this tape, however, I'm going to ask a very important question, and that is, are we committed to struggle? Are we truly committed to equality in America? And if so, what, therefore, is our duty? But first, let's hear the assessment of these individuals 30 years from the original discussion.
Gentlemen, we've survived. Alan Morrison is gone, and Malcolm X was assassinated not all that much after our program together, a couple of years, but long enough for him seemingly to have shifted his own orientation, his sense of separatism, which he was expressing at our program together. Which Malcolm, which civil rights movement is going to be remembered? The separatist, the integrationist?
Well, I think the, and I do not choose to call the phrase integrationist. I think it's desegregationist. I think that's the movement that's going to be remembered. And there were a large cadre of us who were not concerned about being with white people to give any kind of affirmation to ourselves, but to be sure that there was a guarantee that we as American citizens had access to everything else all other Americans had access to. But the verbiage of the media in that time, you know, in a sense brainwashed people's opinions, but we were more desegregationists than we were integrationists.
Do you object to that word, Jim Farmer?
No, I don't object to it. I think it has been redefined and needs further redefinition. It seems to me that what has happened is we had thesis, we had antithesis, and we now have synthesis. Malcolm moved closer toward the civil rights movement after his return from Mecca.
Absolutely.
And the civil rights movement moved closer to Malcolm, with black identity becoming a part of the civil rights struggle. So the mainstream of the United States civil rights struggle today is part integrationist and part black identity and Afrocentrism, if you will. This is a combination of the two, and that's what will be remembered.
And successful?
Well, I don't subscribe to being successful. I remember the morning that I stood by the Washington Monument on the Great March in 63, and I really believe with all my heart that the beloved community was just around the corner, 7 or 8 years away. And now here, 30-some years later or more, I know I will not see it in my lifetime, even if I live to be 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And that's the reality. There's the illusion that progress has been made, but the reality is that what progress has been made has been more cosmetic than it has been consequential.
May I comment on that, too? I missed the March on Washington, by the way. Why?
You were in jail. You were in Parchment State Prison, yes.
And, not Parchment, no. I was in Plaquemine, Louisiana.
Plaquemine's then.
Yeah, right.
Well, you were in jail so much as easily where you were.
Where, yeah. Successful, we were successful in the initial goals. Those were short term or short range. We were fighting against Jim Crow, against segregation, and not against racism, unfortunately, and we may have confused the two. We thought that by knocking down the for colored and for white signs, we would solve the race problem. That was far too simplistic. We did knock out Jim Crow, which was U.S. form apartheid, if you will. But what remained was racism, and that's a concept, that's an idea, that's a belief that the skin color and hair texture has something to do with morality, with character, with intelligence, and other human qualities. That remains with us. Racism is here. And now we've got to exert the same kind of energy and diligence in fighting against racism as we did in fighting against Jim Crow.
Yeah, but Dr. Walker seems to feel that's not a battle that's going to be won. Is that unfair?
I don't think it's going to be won in my time. And the reason I don't think it's going to be won in my time is that my view of American history is that its foundation began with the wedding, voluntarily or involuntarily, of capitalism and racism. Racism was justified by the capitalist system. And until we have a radical change in our economic system in America, I don't think we're going to make any serious dent in the effects and the symbols of racism in our American society.
I don't see much possibility that socialism will come in this country. Certainly it will not be called socialism. It'll be called free enterprise if it does come. But
I think you're right, Jim.
Yeah, but racism can be overcome. We socialize our kids from the beginning of their consciousness to believe that they somehow are superior to people of different cultures, and that being different is somehow being bad. If you do have to be taught to hate, you do have to be taught to be a racist, then it is equally true that you can be untaught.
But let me turn that around. Do you believe that you have to be taught to hate?
Of course you do.
Oh, absolutely.
Of course you do. South Pacific was right in that musical. It said, you have to be taught, you have to be taught, you have to be carefully taught to hate. And it is true. Children, before they are socialized by their parents and their peers and their schools, don't hate people because of differences.
That is the reason, Richard, why so many Americans, white Americans, do not feel or understand that they are racist. They are racist involuntarily. It's the way things have always been, and they think they're being American, and if you're American, you are racist.
Now, may I say, one of the things about Malcolm was that in his pre-Mecca days, he believed that white racism was genetic. In other words, they had it. God, or Allah, as he would have put it, gave it to them, and there's nothing you can do about it. After Mecca, he saw that that was not true. He, in Mecca, saw white Muslims worshiping Allah, kneeling beside him. And he was convinced then that racism, as he had witnessed it in America, was learned and not genetic. And if it is learned, I repeat, it can be unlearned.
So, Jim nearly 30 years ago, you said you thought it would take maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, and you could go fishing. When I remind you of that, you
but Wyatt is right. I'll go fishing in the next life. Now.
Yeah, both of us were more optimistic about the possibility of change in American society than we needed to be. And I confess in this redo that Malcolm was more accurate about an assessment of where America was on race than we were at that point in time.
Yes, but the funny thing is he began to change his position.
Well, Jim has been given a very clear analysis of how the two strains of philosophy move toward each other. And I think he's absolutely accurate in that regard, is that the civil rights movement as we knew it in the 60s, incorporated as a part of it its black identity, Afrocentrism, and Malcolm softened his position about all white people being blue-eyed devils. And that's an absolutely clear and straightforward analysis of what has happened. The side effect has been that with the rise of ethnic pride, somehow, in a bizarre way, the ethnic pride of blacks has induced in other ethnic communities, it has sharpened their resentment and hostility toward people who are not like them.
That's true, too. I do want to emphasize that we made some changes. Wyatt made some changes. The SCLC made some changes. And CORE did, too, in this country. We did wipe out Jim Crow. For all practical purposes, we just overestimated the impact that would have on changing the life condition of the black American.
And I think it needs to be said, although it doesn't sound like from my earlier comments, it was a significant change.
Yes.
When you consider that segregation, both by mores and by legal fiat, had been in place for nearly 100 years, and our movement in a decade and a half completely dismantled segregation
yes.
by mores
that
and fiat.
Right.
So that is a significant, but it did not solve the deeper problem, as Jim has outlined, about racism that was in the body politic of this nation.
And I believe that we can solve that problem, too.
You think there are going to be there'll be Malcolms out there, Malcolm then, when we all were together, nearly 30 years ago, who will say, that's more soft-headed thinking. That's more pie in the sky by and by.
But the second Malcolm, from the time of his visit to Mecca,
right.
would say, that's not pie in the sky, it can be done.
Is that so true?
Yes,
was that disillusionment
true.
On his
no,
part? With...
No, it is true, it can be done, but it has to be done with intentionality and aggressiveness on the part of our government. And our government has never been intentional enough nor aggressive enough on seeing to it that every American citizen is guaranteed the right of access to everything all other Americans have. And I cite as an example the fact that we've had in the climate of America a change in the position of the Supreme Court where they have all but dismantled affirmative action programs, and you had these so-called anti-affirmative action Supreme Court decisions, you know, and a president whose name I don't want to call who talked about quota, a quota bill, you know, all kinds of rationales in order to deter and to obstruct the free access of every American to everything all other Americans.
But maybe President-elect Clinton, I will call his name,
yes.
Will have a different point of view and will take a stronger stand.
Well, he's made an important statement today or yesterday that the Haitians whom the gentleman whose name I don't want to mention turned away, that they will be received.
Maybe he can take the leadership then in starting us off on the right track in fighting against racism in this country, as we fought against Jim Crow years ago.
Let me ask a stickler question here. Do you think that gentleman, Ronald Reagan, whose name you don't want to mention, do you think he did not reflect the country he led?
Reagan, no, he pretty much reflected the country he led because he made, in my view, he made racism popular in America.
Legitimate
and popular. I mean, it was the way to be. And it is because he was so isolated from what was going on in race relations in America, he was supremely naive and or ignorant for a sitting president on matters of race.
And he took the guilt and the shame out of being racist. Now it's all right, people to be racist. Maybe we can turn that around with a new president.
The leadership, then, is what you're saying. Was it the kind of leadership, remember that night before we met, Kennedy's speech,
there was such a high moral quality to that.
Yes, and you must remember not only that speech, but the speech that John Kennedy made in January, when he said very clearly that we didn't need any more civil rights legislation, that there was sufficient, and it was our movement which turned John Kennedy around.
It was Birmingham,
yes,
specifically.
Birmingham specifically turned him around on the matter of the need for new civil rights legislation.
The King and Wyatt Walker demonstrations,
well,
in Birmingham.
We had a lot of help, Jim. You were there with us with your troops as well. It was the one time that all of the movement forces, including some part of the NAACP, joined with us in that great Birmingham confrontation, which brought us to the point where we could not only have a public accommodations bill, but gave us the foundation. It made our movement legitimate on the American scene, and then led to Selma to Montgomery, which brought about the Voting Rights Act, which changed the entire complexion of political activity in the South.
Is there a parallel unity today?
Well, you have a fragmentation. For instance, CORE went off the deep end in nationalism. They did not...
They didn't stay there. They went to right-wing republicanism after that.
Yes.
How did you let that happen? Oh,
I didn't let it happen. It happened after I'd left.
It was infiltrated.
It happened after McKissick, my successor.
Yes.
And now what do you feel? We have 30 seconds left, gentlemen.
Well,
optimism?
SCLC has been forced into being a regional organization. We do not really have a national civil rights movement.
No.
But the hope is that you do have local civil rights activities, which is very bright and very dynamic and very energetic. And that's the hope for tomorrow.
I suppose the hopeful note is reflected, repeated in your own thinking.
Yes, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we can get together now. The movement, the organizations don't have a sense of objective. We don't know where we're going specifically. And that's partly because we fail to have long-range planning.
Yes, I have said that the Achilles heel of our era, Jim, is that we were so optimistic that we did not train the next generation to take over for us when we passed off the scene.
Gentlemen, maybe this program today will help bring you back as examples and leaders. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jim Farmer, Dr. Wyatt T. Walker.
People get ready.
Jim Farmer.
Oh, there's a train coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get a home on board. All you need is faith to hear the diesel's humming. You don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord. I believe. Oh, yes, I believe. I believe. Oh, I believe.
Alrighty, well, we just heard the conclusion, and I think it was a very remarkable insight by James Farmer and Wyatt T. Walker, looking back at their work, their handiwork, as it were, in moving this nation along to basically embrace the spirit and the letter of the Constitution, and making life a lot easier by their struggle and their sacrifice. We do have to thank them. We have to thank them for persevering, because this was not the enterprise of dilettantes. This was people committing to action for most of their productive lives. That's an extraordinary contribution. There's no way you can repay people for doing that kind of service to everybody, not just African Americans, because I maintain that the civil rights struggles of African America humanized the society from day one. It has always been about humanizing the society. All oppressed people have that in common, that they seek justice, they seek their rightful place in a society, very often even after being just pilloried and targeted. What did we hear? We heard that they were fighting, they realized they were fighting Jim Crow, but not racism. And that's an extraordinary admission. Jim Farmer talked about it was, as he finally came to see, it was a U.S. form of apartheid. And racism is a belief. It is an idea, he said. Racism was justified by capitalism. That's what he said. This is brilliant insight that we're getting. And racism, nonetheless, sharpened resentment by whites to blacks. They both talked about the high hopes they had for a guy named Clinton. And I have a little story to chime in here of my own. When Bill Clinton was running for president, there was this hurriedly put together press conference or press meeting, I guess, with a candidate in Manhattan for the black press. And usually, whenever they do something for the black press, it's usually a cattle call. You know, everybody gets in the same room, whereas with the white press, they would sit down and give exclusives. But when they talk to the black press, if they talk to the black press, I'm still waiting for Barack Obama to actually talk to the black press. They put you in a room and the candidate sits down and gives, you know, perfunctory answers to basically even perfunctory questions. And then Bill Clinton came in for, I think it didn't even last 15 minutes. And my question to him at the time was, what was going to be his foreign policy toward Africa and the Caribbean? And he looked at me and he was absolutely angry. His whole face got red. And he said he didn't have one. I said, you don't have one? you are coming to the black community for the vote, aren't you? You have no foreign policy whatsoever, because the issue at the time was the interdiction of Haitians in the high seas, many, many hundreds of them literally dying in the ocean. He did not have a policy, he said. Here's the odd thing. When this was all over, a publisher, I won't call his name, but a publisher of a major paper in the city of New York, black publisher, called me aside and said that I ought to have been ashamed of myself. Really? Why? You don't ask those kinds of questions. The man is running for president, he said. Like I said, you know, I didn't have a copy of Amos Wilson's book at the time, The Psychology of Self-Hatred and Self-Defeat, to give him. But that's what he said to me. I embarrassed the man who was going to be president. How dare I ask a legitimate question? But as it turned out, Clinton was an embarrassment and an absolute charlatan when it comes to the interests of black people in this country and outside of it. And we will be talking about Mr. Clinton very shortly with respect to Haiti, very shortly. Ronald Reagan made racism legitimate and popular. He took the guilt and shame out of being a racist. Kennedy, though he spoke with high moral quality, he said, high moral authority, sorry, they had to really bang his head and they had to ram him up against a wall for him to actually do the right thing. So when people talk about John Kennedy and the Kennedys as the great bastions of modern day morality and you know, just bleeding hearts for all people. You should know that. The Kennedy administration is similar to the administration we're experiencing now, similar to the Clinton administration. Total contempt. And this is why I worry that a large sector of the African-American community just refuses to see it. So the question to us now, and I'm opening up the phones at 888-874-4888. We have listened. Hopefully we have learned. And we can now ask questions because, as I say, this one thing, if you were listening, you heard them come back to it time and again. And they were, in a way, regretful that it slipped them. It slipped past them that they thought they were fighting something, but in the end, they were fighting Jim Crow, the physical manifestation of racism. But they were not, they realized they didn't actually engage racism because it's virulent. It really is. And that is the challenge that I continue to pose to the progressive community, black and white, and Latino. Where do you stand? What is the unfinished business that has to be done within these communities? And have we lost the zeal? Have we lost the interest in civil rights movements? Are we basically regarding it as a kind of spectator sport? You know, we can turn it on, turn it off on our TV. We watch a little thing here and a little thing there. We see a documentary here and there. But essentially, we're beyond that. We're in the post-racial society. What are your thoughts? 888-874-4888. And while you dial in, I just want to say, no, I'm not ignoring the drones, because we will get to that tomorrow. And I will get to that from a historical point of view, seeing that people are hysterical today about it, and they're wondering about, oh, my goodness, all these killings and so forth. And you ought to wonder. But you see, for some of us, there's a flip side to every story. For some of us, this is not news. This is not news. In fact, one of the participants in this very discussion, Malcolm X, was targeted for assassination in a foreign country several times. So we're used to this kind of thing. Many of our leaders have fallen because they were targeted. So I understand now that it is becoming an issue, but again, in the same way that we have this racial bifurcation in America, we also have a historical bifurcation. The issues that have long been plaguing a large part of America just simply have gone unnoticed, and it now becomes an issue because somebody decides it's an issue. Well, okay, we'll get to that tomorrow. Well, anyway, 1-888. I keep saying one, but you know to dial what it is. It's 888-874-4888. Let's finish up this discussion today, and let's talk frankly about what you learned from this, these 3 days of this discussion. Hello, Michael. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Trace. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
The issues with regard to what you've been playing for the last couple of days are so vast that I could only begin to scratch the surface.
Well, take a little shot, you know, take a little piece out of it and deal with it. Let's hear what you see.
It's vast. It covers, like, so much. But really, I'm struck by the issue that you brought up in another program, whether we're talking about civil rights and human rights. And I think this cuts down to the bone here, because when you're talking about racism and discrimination, you know, if it's human rights, then you'll deal with racism. This is my opinion. And if it's civil rights, then you're going to deal with discrimination. And sorry.
Even your dog agrees.
My dog is getting antsy. Now, you know, with discrimination, you're dealing with rigid laws, and frankly, the human psyche and the drives of human beings will overcome any kind of structure or law or fence or, you know, enclosure that you'll put them in. And so if you're dealing with discrimination, you're going to create laws, et cetera, to deal with that. And perhaps that's what, you have to do to begin with. But I don't know, if there are any mechanisms to deal with racism. I'm not sure I even agree with the gentleman when he says that racism is learned so much. I guess it's learned, but in a sense, it's, if you reflect on that book, Lord of the Flies, you throw any group of people on an island and, you know, these animalistic, tribalistic kinds of things come about. It's the pecking order. It's an animalistic kind of human nature that comes out, which maybe we inherited from the animals, from the barnyard. But, you know, this is where I would place this racism. It's at a deep level. And if you criticize it or justify it, those are surface things that don't do anything to it. But I think if we're aware of it... I'm sorry?
Sorry. Personally, as it relates to you, personally.
Yes.
Did you find yourself asking yourself any questions?
Well,
about you personally.
Well, you know, I kind of agree with you in so many areas, but it's kind of infuriates me. I mean, I don't even try to watch TV, but I put on MSNBC. I see that Melissa Perry lady comes on, and she's supposed to be some kind of a post-racial person that comes out and says, you know, now that we have a black president, we don't really have an issue with race anymore. Isn't that great? I don't know if you see these little vignettes that they put on MSNBC.
No, I don't watch it that long.
I can't stomach it anymore myself. But what do we have there? So, I think that in a sense, Obama and his little cadre of supporters on MSNBC, they're doing an injustice to the black community, the Hispanic community, and every minority, and equality and justice in the United States, because they're putting on a mask that we're beyond these issues. And we haven't even scratched the surface, as you say. These people spoke 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the issues are the same, or they're worse in some instances.
Truth is, this discussion actually was 50 years ago, half a century ago, was the first gathering. And what we just heard was 30 years after the first meeting.
Yeah,
and that was 20 years ago.
So this is the thing. I think people have to learn to be civil. People have to learn to be rational and logical. But I don't think they are civil, rational, and logical. I think that I don't think they're born with racism. But on the other hand, it's something that's much more easily picked up than rationality and civility. And I think that's what, people bring into this situation. And, I think it's just what I'm saying is just the very beginning of a conversation, because, people have done work on discrimination and the laws. The Jim Crow law was, 18-something, and they said that the federal government has no right to interfere in our discrimination and our, our animalistic behavior. Okay, so it took, from 90s, whatever, when the Jim Crow law was established with Plessy versus Ferguson, suggesting that they can't do anything about it, and it took them, however many years to the 1950s. Over 50 years to address that, to begin to chip away at creating laws which prevent discrimination. But preventing discrimination with rigid laws has no impact on racism. And so because people are the way they are, they can discriminate in ways that the laws can't touch. And then you create a new anti-discrimination law, they'll find a loophole and they'll get around it to discriminate against people in some other way.
Well, you know, the foundational philosophy of the United States, the premises that informed the decision to forge a country out of somebody else's country, from that moment on, the society was structured to benefit the first settlers and their progeny. And it has continued. It doesn't matter who is in the White House, in one form or the other, there is the first allegiance is to maintain that power arrangement. And in doing so, you maintain the, quote, American identity. That's the American identity. And we can see in so many ways in which, even with Barack Obama, he's maintaining the original identity of this nation and will not in any way change it. So, you know, we do end up with these kinds of contradictions. But, Michael, you started us on a very good discussion, and thank you so much for contributing to it. We have a lot to think about from what you have offered us today. Thank you. Thanks a lot. 888-874-4888. I want to touch a bit on what Michael just raised about media. And the assumption is that people in the media are somehow knowledgeable. They're not. They come from the point of view that there is nothing that they can't know because they're just a couple of keystrokes away on a computer of acquiring knowledge. They tend not to read very much. They tend not to have a broad view. They tend not to be conversant with issues. So, like today, we will be subjected to a barrage of information about drones, and there'll be a big hysterical reaction in the media over drones. Not that this isn't a serious issue. It is a serious issue. But it's been a serious issue for a long time, and under several presidents. And you want to talk to Latinos, you want to talk to African Americans especially, and you want to talk about how people have been targeted for assassination and annihilation by government entities, the U.S. government entities. We have a lot of experience in this area. So this is not, again, this is not something dramatically new to us. The only thing that is different is the technology. The technology has evolved. But our leadership, I mean, we could recite chapter and verse on people in leadership capacities who were, of course, distanced and denounced by the various administrations, who suddenly died, and died quite mysteriously. So it is a marvel that people who are in the media cannot easily retrieve this information and say, well, wait a minute, let's have a perspective, because things don't just happen in a vacuum. These things have happened before. Many communities have experienced this before, targeted assassinations. So it isn't new. It's maybe new to you, but in some people in the media, but this is not new. So we should not feed into the hysteria of the moment. But we should take a look at the issue. It's a very important issue. But it is not, despite the best efforts of the media to make it a brand new thing that, you know, they've just discovered, therefore it is just discovered. No. There are those of us who know what happened. I want to give folks an assignment for tomorrow. homework assignment for tomorrow, because we'll be talking about drones and other things, but your homework assignment to get a sense of the difference between Democrats and Republicans, because I have been talking about the Democratic Party being the party of racists in the beginning. You want to look up, it was called a massacre then in Opelousas. O-P-E-L-O-U-S-A-S, Opelousas, the Opelousas Massacre. When, in fact, we had something called radical Republicans. Radical Republicans. And in a face-off to affirm the rights of African Americans, a major event occurred, and it also highlights the gun issue, the gun control issue that's now raging. It's a perfect storm, in a way, for study, in which close to 300 blacks were killed. So it's a distant memory, but it is a very fascinating thing. When people start talking about, you know, the Republicans and what they are, well, there's a different point of view about Republicanism as well. So Opelousas, the Opelousas Massacre, or some people call it the Opelousas Riot, but it was a massacre, no question about that. But I want to wrap this up as we get close to the end of our program today. It is important work to constantly see the inequities. When we see them, we point them out and we talk about them. This is the work of the progressives, if in fact we are progressives. And I do not believe that racism is simply a belief system. It is also a science. Racism is a science. Now, what do I mean by that? A science is the application of a formula that yields exactly the same result under the same prevailing conditions. It will yield exactly the same result no matter where it is applied. No matter where you find water, it's H2O. Two molecules, hydrogen, one molecule of oxygen. There's a scientific principle to that. And when James Farmer pointed out it was American-style apartheid, it's the same thing. The formula is exactly the same. It would yield exactly the same result. Racism is a scientific formula, a science to it. How do you maintain supremacy? You develop a formula for it. And I did say to you before, in case you doubt it, I refer you to do some research, and you will find in Thomas Jefferson's quest, mathematical quest for understanding his universe, a very complicated mathematical equation addressing the one question that seemed to baffle him, and that is, how do you rid blacks of their blackness? And he had a formula for it. Look it up. It's in Jane Brodie's biography of Thomas Jefferson. I want to thank you. I hope this has been very helpful in showing us that a lot of the things that we think are new are not. Many people who have come before us have paid an inordinately high price for the privileges that we enjoy and the rights that we enjoy. And we owe it to them, if not to ourselves, but we owe it to them to continue in whichever way we best can to contribute our portion to the advancement of human rights in the United States and beyond. I want to thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Please do pass the word along and let's grow this audience. I really want PRN.FM to be the absolutely must reference for everybody. Coming up next is Jack Rasmus with Alternative Visions, and you can always continue the conversation with me at leadstories, L-E-I-D stories, at gmail.com. Bye-bye.
Oh, people get ready. There's a train in Jordan picking up passengers from coast to coast. Faith is a key. Open the doors and pour them. There is hope for all among those loved the most.